Well, you guys have almost made it all the way through week last. Two more sessions here, and then just finals. Congrats. You guys too. So, lecture 29, December 4, lecture notes page 273. We're up to 29% of the class participating in the course evaluations, which we should be doing anyhow. So we've only added 0.15% out of a potential 0.5%. Go ye forth and do the class evaluations, whether you hate the course or love the course. Give yourself the extra credit, yeah? So go do those things, and we'll increase everyone's extra credit points added to their final course grade. We can do better than 29%. So we're in the last week. This is lecture 29. It looks like we will have content today and probably Wednesday too. Then, of course, the final exam opens next week. So be rocking and rolling then. All of the mini tests are closed, and of course the midterms were closed quite some time ago. The extra credits have been closed, so on average, out of the possible 3 percentage points added to your final course grade, you've earned 2.6%, not too bad, especially when you add in the research extra credit and this upcoming extra credit from doing the course evaluation. Final exam opens Monday, December 11th at 8 a.m., closes Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m., covers lectures 21 to 30 and the associated textbook material. I'll let you know exactly where we get to on Wednesday. Same stuff as always. Bring your ID, textbook, lecture notes. It's open book, open notes. You have a basic calculator if you need it. Can't have mini test questions and answers with you. That would be cheating. You'll be proctored using Proctorio. I don't know what else to tell you. Any questions on the final exam? When it is, what it is, why we have to do it, how much it counts for, anything? Webbies, anything? Okay, well then we're all good. I love it when something comes across my desk that's spot on with what we're talking about, as we have for today's marketing the news. It's just what we're talking about in this idea of social media marketing. How many of you guys know the North Face? They make a pretty good product as far as you know, yeah? Well, here, somebody didn't agree with that. So the North Face turned a viral TikTok customer complaint into a marketing win. As a TikTok from an angry The North Face customer began to go viral, it seemed to spell trouble for the brand, which was accused of selling a waterproof raincoat that didn't live up to the billing. It wasn't waterproof. But a quick thinking, savvy social media response by the company turned the situation into a marketing win. So we're hearing about the importance of social media, allowing customers to voice their complaints and feel, not hey, but they feel they're being heard, part of social customer relationship management. I've got a bone to pick with the North Face, began the video posted November 16th from a woman identifying herself as Jen Jansen at Fanny Pack 310. It showed her soaking wet, hiking up a mountain in New Zealand. I don't want a refund, she said in the video. I want you to redesign this raincoat to make it waterproof and express deliver it to the top of Hooker Valley Lake in New Zealand, where I'll be waiting. I'll be the only one up there looking like a drowned rat. She got a lot of shares on this, but let's take a look at the actual video a second, see what she said.
I've got a bone to pick with North Face. I bought this rain jacket a couple days ago because the tag in the advertising said that it was waterproof, as a rain jacket would be. Well, listen, I'm 100% sure that it's raining outside and I'm soaking wet. Oh, look, this is really pretty. Listen, I don't want a refund. I want you to redesign this raincoat to make it waterproof and express delivery it up to the top of Hooker Valley Lake in New Zealand, where I will be waiting. Ooh. I'll be the only one up here looking like a drowned rat. Waterproof my ass.
So, she was not happy with the lack of waterproofness of her raincoat. The video didn't exactly go quietly into the wet night. By the time the North Face noticed it a few hours later, the TikTok had close to 1 million views. Things can go up quickly, as you know, on the internet. According to the North Face Director of Social and Community, what am I supposed to say, Maureen Hamilton, social media going viral, the importance of tracking brand mentions on social media. You better be paying attention, folk. Upon seeing the video, Hamilton said her team got to work on a response video. The North Face's response video, published just a few days later on November 21st, shows someone from the brand answering Jensen's call to action. Viewers can see someone from the brand running to a North Face store, grabbing a new waterproof raincoat, then getting on a helicopter and meeting the creator of the original TikTok at the top of the mountain before it says giving her the coat. He rings the bell at her. So, she's now a happy customer, presumably. The North Face's response video currently has 4.2 million views, making one of the best performing TikToks to date. A TikTok posted by the North Face before the viral response received about 72,000 views. The video is filled with positive comments, with some users saying it is inspiring them to become customers. I want to buy one only because of this video, wrote user at KRizzo0 in the comments. So here's the positive impact of good social media customer relationship responses. Although these types of brand reactions might be seen as expensive, after all, renting a helicopter or buying a new car, in an example that I didn't show you here, Hamilton said that this video was a financially savvy choice for the North Face. Why? If we look at what we spent on this versus what it would cost to pay to get 4.2 million impressions, it's a very, very efficient way for us to get our product out there, said Hamilton. So I would say, nicely done, good use of social media, and being attentive to what the world is saying about your brand, and then acting. So on Election Notes, page 273, chapter 20, and page 573 in the textbook, speaking about social media marketing. So we left off last time doing a little comparison of social media marketing and traditional marketing, made some of these points about the difference between the two, and we were picking up with some of the advantages of social media marketing as compared to traditional media. So in general, social media marketing is a lot cheaper. You can reach thousands, or in this case, from our example, millions of people for a fraction of the cost using social media as compared to what it would cost you if you were trying to do it with television, billboards, or even email. Social media is the only marketing platform that allows you to engage and interact with your consumers. It's a two-way relationship, unlike television, radio, magazines, billboards. Two-way relationship, which can be hugely lucrative for brands. The results are measurable, and marketers can take immediate action to spark trends and realign campaigns. I'm going to use an example here, which I might also use later on, because I forget where I put it. But we had a graduate of our program a while ago go to work for an auto parts place, auto-related industry down here, not too far away, doesn't matter. The point is, she studied search engine optimization with us, took that skill to the company, and she said in the moment, as she changed the appropriate words on their website to be current to whatever was happening, she could watch the flow of traffic change on the website, on the company's website, helping to control people coming to the website in the moment. And if things weren't working as they should, she could change up the appropriate search terms, so you can take immediate action. But social media campaigns can be time consuming. Certainly it takes a good amount of time to come up with good viral videos, etc. The impact can disseminate very quickly, whereas traditional marketing campaigns, certainly intelligent, can produce short-term results that have greater tangibility. So lots of advantages, some relative disadvantages. So how can you best use social media to communicate with your audiences? Well, first of all, one more time, it all starts with your target audience, with the consumer. Where are they now? Are they Instagram? Are they TikTok? Are they Facebook? is the leading social networks ranked by brand awareness in 2022. The most well-known social networks in the U.S. were YouTube, Facebook, with a brand awareness each of 92%. Third in 2022 was Instagram, 88% of U.S. respondents knowing them, closely followed by TikTok, Twitter, and Snapchat. At the bottom of the rankings are Truth Social and Clubhouse. Do you guys know Clubhouse? Do you guys know Clubhouse? No, we're going to come to that in a little bit. It's an interesting special place, invitation only, where you can actually interact pretty deeply with some pretty important people by invitation. It's a little different than, say, TikTok. Anyhow, so where's your audience is the question, because that's going to drive some of your social media interaction, right? By platform in 2022, users, not just awareness, Facebook, 180.7 million users, Instagram, 126 million, TikTok, 91 million, Pinterest, 90 million, Snapchat, 89 million, LinkedIn. How many people are on LinkedIn? Yay! If you aren't on LinkedIn, you ought to find out what that's about. It could be important one day. Twitter, X, and Reddit. This is, you guys know Damon John from Shark Tank? Yeah. We actually had him as a keynote speaker at an event we sponsored with Akron's Better Business Bureau. This is Damon John talking about how you communicate on different platforms with different audiences. Who is your audience? How do you appeal to them?
And I use all forms of technology, and I want people to be very clear. You cannot communicate the same way on every form of technology. When you look at your platforms, you can't talk the same way. LinkedIn, you know, you have to communicate like you are where we are today. We are networking. We're at a great conference. Everybody's business or business casual, and that's how you communicate. When you are on Instagram, you communicate like the cool kids in the park with the funny mustaches and the tight pants. No problem. When you are on Facebook, you are in a family reunion. Make sure Nana, you are communicating the way Nana likes it and Aunt Mary. And when you're on Twitter, you are out in the park and it is going crazy out there and there's a whole bunch of random people there. You have to communicate certain ways. I'm using these technologies, the form of Clubhouse, and start speaking off and on there because what am I doing? I'm able to articulate a little more clearly where I'm going in life, what I believe, and how I can empower others. Because, yeah, you may see a tweet or you may see something else, but you may not be able to get the full value out of it because it's a couple of sentences or an image. And what do I get after that, after being on Clubhouse? I get more feedback, right, on what is working, what people need to know more of, what people do not like. That's how I'm using technology to communicate with my customer and also see who they are, what keeps them up at night, and what do they think about me?
So he says, know your audiences, know what the platform is, know how they interact on that platform, and obviously change your approach depending on the platform and how people interact with it. Clubhouse being the special case where he gets to talk to people by invitation in depth. So what platform should you be on? Well, the platform is never as important as the story you need to tell to that particular target audience. What are the social media habits of your target audience? Which platform aligns with your brand's long-term goals? Do you want to be seen as a family-oriented company where Aunt Murray is paying attention? Do you want to see as being a wild child out there amongst the people in the park? What presences have you already established? Where are people already looking for you? Would obviously drive your social media style. Do not just create and duplicate content across multiple platforms. For one thing, it's just spamming your audience. If your audience follows you on Facebook and on Instagram and on Twitter, and you're sending them the same message over and over again, that's not a good way to keep them coming back. Plus, presumably, the platforms have different styles. So you need to adjust your content to those styles. So for example, you're selling baby carriers to young mothers. That's your market. Most young mothers probably have an Instagram account, yeah? A Facebook account, Pinterest account, YouTube account, Snapchat account. But you don't blindly post about your baby carriers on all these platforms. It becomes useless spam. They're just hearing the same message over and over again. You need to really understand how young mothers are using these social media platforms. You need to understand consumer behavior. So young mothers might use Facebook to stay in touch with their family, YouTube to learn from other mothers, Instagram to follow their closest friends, Pinterest to keep track of their favorite baby products, Snapchat to share pictures with her college friends. So they have different needs for each of these platforms. So you, now being attuned to how they're using these things, need a unique strategy for each platform. You might use YouTube to focus on how-to videos, because one of your goals may be to educate the audience on how to use your baby carriers. You could use Instagram or Pinterest to share lifestyle photos of mothers using your products to humanize your brand. You could encourage young mothers to share their experiences of using baby carriers by creating user-generated content, UGC. You can make hashtags specific to your brand and encourage customers to post pictures, stories, and testimonials with those hashtags. Love the baby carrier. This will not only engage your existing customers, but also, presumably, attract potential customers who follow it, who see what's going on, who become interested. Then, of course, you need to be sure to actively participate in conversations and engage with your target audience by responding to comments, to direct messages, to mentions, and make them feel they're part of the family, part of the group. Run contests and giveaways on your social media channels. Organize contests, giveaways, or promotional campaigns to incentivize engagement. Get people involved. Ask users to share their favorite baby-wearing moments. Tag friends. Submit creative content related to baby carriers. Offer prizes like discounts, free products, or exclusive access to new releases to get them involved in the community, to keep them active. Collaborate with influencers. Partner with influential bloggers, vloggers, social media personalities who have a strong presence among young mothers, your target audience. These influencers can review your products, demonstrate how it's used, share their experiences with their followers, and this can significantly boost brand visibility and credibility because people come to trust these influencers. One of the main reasons why many businesses are on too many social media platforms is fear of missing out, FOMO. But despite this, your audience does not need to hear from you on every single platform they're using. Mastering two or three platforms is more likely to lead to a loyal following than being mediocre on lots of platforms. The quality that you share with your target audience on your platforms is more important than quantity, than being everywhere. A company that you don't typically think of as being a social media powerhouse? Oreo. How many of you guys like Oreo cookies? Not that many. Oreo is one of the best companies in the world in terms of social media marketing. Oreo recently conducted its highly successful 100-year anniversary campaign, an effort that won the company numerous awards and garnered significant attention in social and traditional media channels. With a new Oreo campaign called Wonder Filled, you see Oreo filled with a stuffing, get it? Wonder Filled, marketers are watching to see if the cookie company can continue its recent string of successes. One of the cornerstones of Oreo's 100-year anniversary campaign was the Oreo Daily Twist initiative. Each day for 100 days, Oreo released a cookie image that often played off on daily news events, with the content including a Shark Week-themed Oreo and a Mars Rover Oreo. The promotion led to a very impressive four-fold increase in the Facebook shares for Oreos as the target audience saw what was going on, got excited about it, shared it with other people.
How does a product that hasn't changed a lick in 100 years find its way to the center of the cultural dialogue? It takes a lot of bravery and a little swagger. The strategy was to reimagine pop culture through the eyes of Oreo. We called it Daily Twist, an ambitious exercise in real-time culture jacking. 100 days, 100 twists. Oreo translated each piece of pop culture into shareable social content. Agency partners and brand stakeholders created a virtual newsroom, collaborating to create a new piece of content every single day. It was a risky move for our 100-year-old brand, but we believed in the power of real-time social content. See, It wasn't just about making stuff. It was about creating a platform for conversation. We made the content talkable. And people talked. And for the final twist, we handed it over to our fans to decide. Daily Twist became a living, breathing part of culture, just like Oreo has been for over a century. Some pretty important people noticed. From classic cookie to media darling, we've changed the way a new generation experiences Oreo, and we're just getting started.
You got to give them some credit. I mean, if I gave you the task of coming up with an idea to make a 100-year-old brand of cookie relevant on social media, you might not have come up with that idea. I know I wouldn't have, but good for them. Bringing creativity to it, getting consumers involved. Another big win for Oreo on social media came in the form of the Oreo blackout tweet, which capitalized on the temporary blackout at Super Bowl, whatever that was, 2013, with a clever social media post. Oreo's well-timed response resulted in 525 million earned media impressions for the brand and wildly expanded its visibility in the social media landscape. With attention to audience attention high, they followed the blackout tweet by asking fans to pick their favorite part of an Oreo cookie and make their opinion known on an Instagram post, complete with the hashtag cookie this or hashtag cream this. The promotion drew more than 46,000 submissions. And within 3 days, Oreo had used those submissions to inspire 148 sculptures that were photographed and posted on Instagram to further extend the campaign. Oreo's efforts have produced the results. Before the Oreo blackout tweet, the company's Instagram followers were 2,200. After the tweet, it was over 85,000. Obviously getting some involvement through that. So what are some key digital strategies, sort of coming back to the strategic level? Connectivity. You may have heard me say this before. You need to know where your target audience is, and that's where you have to be, despite where you like to be. You need to be credible and believable. If you're not, then of course consumers are not going to share your message. So what's it take for your target audience to make you credible, to make you believable, to be authentic? Getting users to create and share believable messages for your brand is one way to be credible and believable. Have an idea to engage consumers, which will build community. It'll create places where users can interact with information that interests them. Have a custom microsite on brand, on topic, a Facebook app, a brand site where consumers can come together and talk about the North Face jacket or the cookie that they like. They'll become engaged. We haven't heard from Shane in a while. Shane was an affiliate marketer, so he's using he was using website searches to share information, suggest products, and if you bought the product that he suggested, he got a little piece of the puzzle. So Shane is back talking to us here a little bit.
Yeah, affiliate marketing has a role in social media. I think social media, the conversation is just different. My specialty is in search marketing, where people are searching for a solution to their problem. Social media is more like interruption marketing, where they're doing something else and you're kind of in their face with an offer. So they both have different places. In general, it's easier to sell something to someone who's already looking for it than interrupting their daily life. So as an affiliate marketer, it's easier for me to make a sale and build a business in the search world than the social media world.
So if you're on Facebook and you're scrolling through, you see an ad for a pain relief product, you don't pay much attention to it, it's just there. If you happen to have back pain and you're looking for a product and his site pops up and he has three recommended solutions, suddenly he says you're engaged in search marketing, you're much more likely to buy it than if it's just scrolling by in your social media feed, yeah? So he engages in search marketing as an affiliate marketer.
Yeah.
So believability plus engagement is often going to end up in your story going viral. It occurred with the North Face in a negative way. People believe she was upset. and in a positive way. They liked what North Face did to cure the problem. So engaged, active users will share your story with the world in their voice, positively or negatively. You want it to be positively, of course. So to benefit, you have to acknowledge that consumers are in control. Unlike television advertising, you aren't in control of things. Things happen. They get posted. You got to pay attention. So you need to be found where consumers are looking. They're going to find you as opposed to you sending out a message to them per se. You need to have conversations, not sales pitches. I went to a social media conference a while ago, and they said out of every 5 things that happen in your social media feed, 3 of them should be information, interesting stories. 1 could be maybe something about the competition, and 1 could be a sales pitch. But people don't come to your website for a sales pitch and sit there done. Engage consumers in what interests them, whatever it might be. Outdoor vacationing, weather in New Zealand. This is, of course, Dilbert showing us how not to do it. So the stupid pointy-haired boss says, Beth is our new marketing manager for social media. By the way, Beth, company policy forbids the use of Facebook and Twitter at work, and we don't trust you to work from home. And if you blog about how lame we are, you're fired. Beth says, first day, not so good. They don't quite get social media there. So how can we move beyond social media just to build community? How can it generate sales? Well, it can build retention and loyalty. By offering your customers the ability to connect with you and with each other, you can turn your target market into a community. The sense of belongingness to a community can increase their brand loyalty, keep them coming back, and keep them buying more. Community and acquisition. Just as you can find out about a friend's interests and likes on Facebook, your customers' networks of other people will know that they trust you and they're a loyal customer of yours. So the next time someone in their network is looking for a product or service that you sell, they'll remember your brand and be more likely to buy from you. Social media can generate trust and make use of user-generated content. Social media can help you develop powerful, compelling content that resonates with your customers through user-generated content. When you open up your product to user reviews, you send a message that you have nothing to hide, nothing to fear, and it helps the consumer trust your brand more. By giving customers access to independent third-party feedback, you're helping them make a better purchasing decision. When a consumer is more comfortable, they're more likely to buy. I digress off the slide. I recently pulled up an article and haven't read it. Maybe you know this too. People being skeptical about all those positive online reviews and seeing that there are a lot of them that are generated, they're fake. You've heard that perhaps. Sometimes people are paying people to give positive reviews. Not what we're talking about here. There is bad behavior no matter where you go. So watch out for that sort of thing, the bad behavior stuff. But when it's honest, it generates trust. Search engine acquisition, optimization and acquisition, just what I was chatting about a little bit ago. Side effect of opening up your product to community activity and user-generated content is that you increase your chance of rankings on all kinds of medium to long tail keywords. So people search the internet for something related to your business, boom, they find you. So you increase your chances of reaching out to a targeted user who may have already made the decision to buy. They're actively searching for the product, and because you're out there, you're active, your company is picked up in the search. Drive foot traffic. Even if you're a bricks and mortar store, social media can drive traffic to your store. The web has gone mobile, and so it's no social networking. More and more of what users are doing are location-based. That means you can just reach out to potential customers who are quite literally just around the corner. The social network Foursquare allows users to, quote, check in to physical locations such as a cafe through their mobile phones. Their personal network is then updated about their physical location. And when we see that someone we trust frequents a certain store, we're curious to check it out too, so it can increase foot traffic to the store. How do we know if we're being effective? We keep talking about how easy it is to measure, how effective in social media campaigns. So typically what we're used to doing in the old days is calculating return on investment. What are engagement in advertising, magazines, television brings to the bottom line? But social media campaigns are a little different. They require assessing things a little differently. For example, return on engagement. How long do people spend on your social media site, either engaging in conversation, interacting with your white papers, with your stories, with your videos, and in turn, what happens as a result of that engagement that's worthy of measurement, a little different than just straight up return on investment. Return on participation, this is tied to the idea of measuring and valuing the time spent participating in social media through conversations or maybe the creation of social objects because you're running a user-generated contest. Return on involvement, sort of like participation. These are touch points for documenting states of interaction. They tie in metrics and the potential return on all of the touch points that your consumers engage in on your social media sites. Return on attention. In the attention economy, we assess the means to seize attention, hold attention, and measure the response. 30-second ad on television comes, go, people go to the bathroom, they aren't paying attention to any of it. They're engaged in your website, they're looking at your offerings, they're looking at your reviews, they're looking at your videos of your products, they're looking at influencers, quite a bit of different attention. Return on trust. A variant on measuring consumer loyalty and the likelihood for referrals. A trust barometer establishes the state of trust earned in social media engagement and the prospect of generating advocacy and how it impacts future business. So it requires a little different mental set and a little different set of metrics as you think about your social media campaign. So we would talk about the five phases of social media measurement. Exposure. Are you getting a desired number of visits to your site, views on your site, a desired number of followers and fans and subscribers and brand mentions? Of those folks that are engaged in exposure, is there a good percentage that become influencers, that talk about your brand, that share your brand in their voice? Of that subset, is there a fair number of people who engage in, who are engaged with your brand through clicks, retweets, shares, DMs, wall posts, etc.? And of course, what about the action? Are there people that are signing up for your white paper, for your coupons, for heads up on new product releases? Are they signing up for free trials? Are they signing up and buying stuff from the online store? Are they attending your webinar? Are they downloading your content? And hopefully all of that eventually becomes online sales. And we do it well, we train it, we start all over again. Now, you need to measure all this stuff, but you have to be smart about it. Here's an example of somebody that didn't quite get the idea of being smart on your analytics and how it played out for them.
Peter, come take a look at this.
Daniels. Look at this.
The numbers, they keep getting bigger and bigger.
The clicks are off the charts.
Yeah.
Yoshi, it's Walter. We're back.
Yes, sir! Somebody, over there! What the?
I need more trees! I'll get you more trees!
Hey, take a look at Woodpulp.
Whoa, everything you got on Woodpulp right now.
He really loves that thing.
Adobe Marketing Cloud will help you avoid watching a little kid punch bye 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 over and over again. So you have to be smart about that. Now, social media marketing is not without risk. It comes with dangers, and dangers of social media marketing, dangers of internet marketing. Cybersecurity, of course, is an issue. So this was actually given to me by a student in one of my classes. He said, I'm an IT manager at a major Fortune 500 company, and much of my time over the last year has been dedicated to protecting my company from, removing the effects of, and educating my user base about the dangers of internet hacking and cyber exploits. One of the most prevalent currently and pertinent to our marketing topic is the proliferation of drive-by downloads or drive-by hacking through subverted internet advertising. Some of my users were recently infected with malware originating from a short-duration compromise on the Yahoo.com search page which was embedded in a fake advertisement. It's becoming increasingly difficult for legitimate advertisers to protect against this type of malicious content, and we've become an area of greater focus for those advertisers that want to continue playing in this arena. Chances are you know not to open that email attachment from the Nigerian prince. He hasn't written me in a long time. Have you guys ever heard from the Nigerian prince offering you a special deal? Who wants to give you 100 grand, but a hack of some NBC.com sites in 2014 proves you can accidentally download malware even when visiting a reputable website. Infecting computers with malware when they navigate to a website is called drive-by download, and cybersecurity experts say it's a growing and terrifying attack technique. Users are simply surfing the web, can unwittingly stumble upon a hacked website which may look completely normal. Clearly, marketing organizations have to be aware of these issues and work diligently to protect their consumers. Yeah, that was 2014, but we're still getting hacks today, as I'm sure you're well aware, yeah? Also, you are out there exposing yourself, as it were, all the time in social media, so you're liable to end up with some form of inappropriate or accidental posting. U.S. Airways has offered an explanation and another apology after a pornographic image was shared from the airline's official Twitter account. Whoops. The carrier said the photo was sent accidentally to one of its customers, who launched a series of complaints against the airline on Monday. The image featured a woman posing with a toy plane, inserting in an inappropriate part of her anatomy. There is no appropriate place to insert a toy plane in your anatomy. We apologize for the inappropriate image we received. We recently shared in a Twitter response. We deeply regret the mistake, and we're currently reviewing our processes to prevent such errors in the future. That would be a good idea, yes. Airline representatives said the image was sent to the airline's Twitter account by another user. Employees in charge of the airline's Twitter account meant to flag the image as inappropriate, but whoops, included it in an reply that went out to other people. Don't do that.
It's an epic Twitter fail, right? It had U.S. Airways apologizing after a lewd photo. I mean, we're talking about lewd. Was posted to their Twitter feed. The company released a statement saying the image was inadvertently included in a response to a customer. I mean, it was so X-rated, it could have been in a porno.
It probably was in a porno. Yeah, really. Now, this is not the first time a big company is trying to save face after big social media blunders. So we have a roundup of some of the major Twitter mistakes out there and social media and everything. So we have expert Peter Shankman with us. Thanks so much for being
here,
Peter.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's just start by talking about this picture. We cannot show the picture.
No.
We don't ever want to see the picture again. We can barely describe the picture on television. But we can show you some of the responses that have come to the picture on Twitter.
All right, so this is one of the first responses, if we can put it up right there, and we'll show you. And it says, who put this guy in charge of U.S. Airways Twitter account? I thought that was pretty funny. And you see that little dummy there. It was a big... Peter's laughing about that. Hopefully you are, too.
Yeah, and there's one more response I want to show you here. Let's see. We can pop it up. Turns out U.S. Airways has way more destinations than we ever imagined.
Want to see that airplane had a layover. Someone at U.S. Airways is terrible at doing their job. Or incredible
good at quitting.
It's bad.
You know, when you have a service that goes out to millions of people without a safe check. You know, I mean, you have to be very aware of what you're saying at any given time. There will be screw-ups. There will be screw-ups that are hacks. There will be screw-ups that are just screw-ups. But this was a mistake.
Yeah, but this is kind of funny because the customer is just calling to complain, really, or just writing or tweeting to complain, saying, you ruined my spring break. I want some free stuff. And then...
ruined a lot more than spring break for a lot of people.
Right. I mean, it probably happened in spring break. But what I'm saying is that, you know, talk about a major blunder. Why wasn't there any fail-safes?
Well, you know, look, when you're dealing in real time, which Twitter is real time, and it's the same reason that celebrities screw up all the time. If you don't have a handler, if you don't have a middle person checking things out, you're going to make mistakes. I've done it. We've all tweeted things that we wish we hadn't, or we typed something wrong, or a typo has come in that looked wrong. The end result is that you're pressed for time, you're looking, you know, it is an immediate response. There are protocols in place to prevent this, and look, U.S. Air sends out hundreds of tweets a week, if not thousands. You know, a lot of them are, hey, sorry, we're late, sorry, our flight's late. This one, some somehow it got through. Now, from what I heard, this was a tweet that was actually sent to American Airlines. And then what probably happened is the social media person there, who also monitors all the other airlines' feeds, American, United, things like that, saw this, probably saved it to send it to some buddies, said, oh my God, look what they sent to American. And then inadvertently, when he saved it, the line of the image was copied to his cut and paste.
Uh-huh.
And he probably, in an effort to try and pick, because, you know, look, when you're doing this every day, sorry, if you have a problem, please post your comments here.
Copying your paste.
He probably just forgot that he had something else in his paste queue, and that's what he said.
Whoops. Okay, we have about 30 seconds left, so we should probably run through some of the other major fails that we've seen. I know Chrysler, they had a bad one.
Yeah, they had an agency working for them that made the mistake of tweeting. You know, you can tweet from multiple accounts. Instead of tweeting from the guy's personal account, he tweeted from the Chrysler account.
Yeah.
Wow, no one in Detroit can effing drive. Not too good coming from a car company.
Please don't drop an F-bomb. Yeah. Also, Epicurious did something.
Yeah, Epicurious, after the Boston bombings about a year ago, they said, you know, our hearts are with Boston. Here's a recipe to make. If you never promote your product ever around a problem or, you know, some sort of tragedy, never promote your product.
And Mickey D's?
Yeah, Mickey D's account was hacked, switched over to Burger King. I'm sorry, Burger King's account was hacked, switched over to McDonald's, and they tweeted a photo of someone shooting up heroin in the bathroom and says, this is what our employees do. So you really, you know, you gotta be careful. Make sure you have, use LastPass or something like that. Make sure you have a good password. Your password should not be password one.
Yeah.
It should not be password two.
Yeah.
It should be lots of letters and numbers. Make sure your account is safe. These things are live and they go out for millions of people.
Peter Shachtman, thank you so much for coming in. And you know what? Lessons learned. Lessons learned, everybody.
Copy paste.
Exactly. Do not copy paste.
And don't fall off this chair. Thank you. All right.
Or lessons not learned over and over again, because still companies make mistakes. But be aware of these things. Have your passwords protected. And watch out for dangers of sending the wrong stuff. If you want to know more about affiliate marketing, Shane Dutka is out there. He can help you build a successful business. And if you want to know about the social media landscape back in 2020, there's a podcast out there. And we also have Social Media Marketing, Marketing 3556. And Digital Marketing is out there, too. I have to update my slide. So there are more courses out there for you if you're interested in the College of Business. All right, so that is that element of the promotion mix. That leaves us with another one to round out our promotional mix strategies. And for this course, we're only going to consider chapter 21 up to page 591, which is personal sales. We aren't going to get into sales management in this course. We do cover it in other courses in the department. So let's think about personal selling. And by the way, again, I move off the slide for a moment. Just today, I got an email from a student who graduated a while ago. And they were writing to one of the profs in the sales area. And they said, you won't believe this. I had no interest in professional selling, never imagined I'd be involved in professional selling, wasn't interested in professional, but I took your class for whatever reason. It was open. They are now a professional salesperson for a major wine distributor. I have to pick up on that a little bit, learn more about them. And they were thanking the department so much for giving this good training in personal selling. So most of you don't imagine you're going to be involved in personal sales. You never know where your future is going to be, I'll tell you. Anyhow, personal selling is a promotional method, one of our things in the promotional mix, in which one party, the salesperson, uses skills and techniques for building a personal relationship with another party, those involved in a purchase decision. That, of course, results in both parties obtaining value, which is what we're about. So again, back to the bolding that we've seen in the prior descriptions of elements in the promotion mix. Personal selling is the two-way flow of paid, it's not hidden, communication between a buyer and an identified seller, often in a face-to-face encounter designed to influence a person or a group's purchase decision process. So two-way, paid, with an identified seller. People know who I represent. There are lots of jobs out there in this area. I guess I updated it a couple years ago from the U.S. Department of Labor, occupational employment and wages in general, and sales and related occupations as a major group, 13 million people involved. Annual mean wage, 46,000, but at the 90th percentile, you get 81 grand. If you get a little more specialized as a sales rep for wholesalers in manufacturing or technical and scientific products, 266,000 people involved. Annual wage, 102,000. You might be able to scrape by on that, with the 90 percentile at 168,000 annual wage. Sales representatives other than technical and scientific products, so wholesaler and manufacturing, 1.2 million engaged, average annual wage, 72,000, and the 90 percentile, $125,000. So there are jobs out there. The thing we aren't going to spend much time on here, other than to define it, is sales management. Sales management consists of the planning of the selling program, implementing, controlling the personal selling efforts of the firm. You won't be there for a little while, although again, I digress to say that students that go through our sales certificate program do rise to manager positions very quickly. So, salespeople create customer value. How do they do that? They identify customers' problems and they find creative solutions to them. So remember what we're doing in marketing, shortcut term, we're discovering and satisfying consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm. Many times your company will do that by personal selling. They also create customer value by assisting the customer with the buying process. Sometimes it's very complex, it's very technical, there's lots of ins and outs. They can help the customer have a successful sales experience. And then, oftentimes, they will be back with the customer doing follow-up after the sale is made, making sure it's operating as it should, answering any questions, and of course, keeping an eye out for future sales. Salespeople build long-term relationships with customers. Sure, you can do that with social media, but sometimes it's the personal touch that makes a difference. So relationship selling is the practice of building ties to customers based on the salesperson's attention and commitment to customer needs over time. Partnership selling or enterprise selling occurs when those salespeople work with customers to combine their expertise and their resources to create customized solutions, to commit to joint planning. Oh, you're coming up with a new AI product. Let's see what we can do to help you bring that out. Share customer, competitive, and company information for their mutual benefit, and ultimately then provide value for the customer. I'm digressing a lot today. Does anybody heard that I think it's Microsoft, is it today, that's releasing a quantum computer into the wild? Anybody follow that story? That's going to be interesting. Help them with their progress in a zero degree, never mind. So what types of sales roles are there out there? Well, on the low end of the totem pole or scale or something, order takers. Order takers primarily assist customers with a purchase. They don't do a lot of sales. It's the greatest number of people engaged in selling, and compensation for order takers is generally lower. So you have retail clerks. We all know them. The equivalent in the B2B world are industrial distributor clerks. They're at the front desk helping you pick up tools from their storage of tools. Some customer service is pretty low end, low value. Order getters is where the money is. That's a position in which a salesperson is actively engaged in using skills to obtain orders from customers. So, congratulations, you've been hired into the Ohio territory. We haven't had a lot of success in Ohio, so what I want you to do is go out there and find new customers for our company. So, doing that can be highly challenging. People don't know your company, they've been working with the competition. But because you're bringing in incrementally new business, we're going to pay you well for it. So it can be very lucrative in terms of earning money. The main objective of new business development is to find new customers. Sales jobs in this category are often fields that are very competitive, but offer high rewards for those that are successful in bringing in that new business. Business equipment sales are used in industries where a company's main profits come from the sale of the supplies and services that come after the initial equipment purchase. So the goal is to get the big corporation or small business to buy the main piece of equipment for which supplies and services are needed to make the equipment function. So copiers are a big deal to the extent companies are still using copiers, Canon, Curacao, Xerox. They don't make a lot of money on the big machine itself. They make a boatload on the maintenance, on the ink, on the supplies that all go with those copiers. So folks get out there to sell the copiers. Outgoing telemarketing, where we sell products over the phone, either to business or consumers, as you would guess, B2C, consumer telemarketing, not real a big thing today. U.S. laws restrict unsolicited phone selling to customers, but in the B2B world, still a big deal, still a big thing. People still engage in outgoing telemarketing to get business. Consumer selling, obviously some companies use salespeople to build new customer business. Retailers, selling certain high-priced consumer products, furniture, electronics, clothing. We still do have personal salespeople selling products. Housing products, including real estate, security services, building replacement products, windows. Actually worked for us a couple years ago. Our windows were getting, they had the original wooden windows, they're getting a little warped, a little air coming through. Anderson comes knocking on the door in the neighborhood. Come on in, give me your pitch. Okay, I think we bought Window Nation, but that's not the main point. So we did buy a new set of windows from a professional salesperson. In-home product sellers, including those selling door-to-door, those products sold at home party events, which I think we talked about a couple discussions ago, cosmetics, kitchenware, decorative products, and some of them have actually been engaged in those home parties, where we are, in essence, professional salespeople. Account managers, these are folks who build customer relationship from that initial sale all the way through the process to follow up account servicing, and they develop those relationships with their clients. So in B2B selling, these salespeople sell products for businesses to use with an emphasis on that follow-up sales. They may have many different items from their company, a broad or deep product line. So after that initial sale, we've established trust, we've established a relationship, I brought you value. Now there's opportunity for me to find other spaces in your company for you to buy products as that buyer-seller relationship grows. Patrick Gorgon, if you remember, he's over at Protégé in that research company. Talk to us a little bit about account management over at Protégé.
So I joined Protégé as an account manager. In general, with account management, what that means is that you're going to be working with an established contact or customer and working with them oftentimes in a project basis. So that with Protégé, I might work with a client 10 times in a year, I might work with them 100 times in a year. And so you definitely want to make sure that you're helping them achieve their goals. So having meetings around what their initiatives are, what are they struggling with, what would it look like for them to be more successful in their position. In this case, it was collecting those consumer insights for researchers. So that's what I was helping them identify and talking to how we can help them achieve that. So that's kind of like maintaining the relationship. But that would only be 60% of the job, because the other 40% is that you want to also expand that relationship. You don't want the account to be stagnant and not be growing year over year. And so that's where we would go fly across the country, do different events with them, or take them out to dinner, bring them lunch, have meetings, really just kind of trying to stand out from, you know, say our competitors who might just be hiding behind email. Of course, you know, we're all human, so having that personal connection really helps, as simple as it sounds. I saw it make a big difference in my role. There were several instances where, say, I was working with a project manager or procurement specialist that was in charge of managing their panels. That was great, but that person might not be privy to information that's coming from the top, say with like the C-level team. So then that's when you really need to expand relationships within that account to make sure that you're touching base with everybody, seeing what initiatives they've got coming up so that you can kind of stay ahead of all the trends that they've got on their end.
So you're developing relationships, you're bringing value, you're helping them solve problems. By the way, you can choose worse careers than helping people solve their problems and bringing value to their companies, and at the same time expanding those relationships, learning through their network who else you might be able to help.
So
account managers then take a couple different approaches. You can take a push approach, where sales professionals work for consumer products companies They don't normally sell to the final consumer. They aren't knocking on your door asking if you want to buy breakfast cereal. Their role is focused on first getting distributors, such as wholesalers and retailers, to handle their products. Then, in turn, they help those distributors to sell their product by offering ideas for advertising, in-store displays, sales promotions to push the order down the channel. Order influencers are another kind of sales role. They're also known as missionary salespeople. They do not engage in direct selling activities. Instead, they concentrate on selling activities that target those who influence the purchases made by the final consumer. Pharmaceuticals are one example of missionary sales. Those salespeople, known as product detailers, discuss products with doctors, with influencers, who then write prescriptions for their patients, the final customers. They don't sell the products directly to the customer. But also in higher education, we have missionary sales. Salespeople call on college professors, the influencers, who make requirements for students, the final customer, to buy specific textbook material. So people come and talk to me. I don't buy the product directly, but rather I influence students' purchase of those textbooks. So that's another sort of sales role that's out there. If you get a technical degree for a technical product, you may be involved in technical sales. So you might be a technical specialist. Used for sale of technical products, particularly in business markets, salespeople have to draw on the expertise of others to assist with the process. A robotic manufacturing line, a oil plant installation, a massive refrigeration unit, you might need technical specialists involved. So it's particularly the case when buying party consists of a buying center, a whole bunch of people that have to make that decision for the client company. Office support is one of the various sales support personnel that's out there. Salespeople are hired for sales because they enjoy getting out, talking to people, solving their problem, not because they like sitting behind a desk. So they really appreciate it when they can get support from the office. So, what sorts of support do office support people provide? Well, they can help create promotional materials for the salespeople to take out. They can help them set up appointments so they don't have to waste their time doing that. They can help find sales leads for prospects who might be interested in their product. They can arrange meeting space for you to meet with your client. They can organize trade shows and exhibits where you go out and show your product to a whole bunch of people. What are some trends in personal selling? Well, something we talked about before a couple of times by now, controlled word of mouth promotion, a version of buzz marketing. Here we get individuals to spread positive information about a product, but in a way that doesn't make it obvious to others that they're being paid to do so. So let's put a red line through that. It was a practice at one time. It may still be done today. We don't do that anymore. If you have a product from us that we've given to you, tell people that we've given you the product. If we're actually paying you, admit that we're paying you. Let's not hide from the consumer that that's what's going on. So there certainly was concern that paying people to act as if they're interested in a product without any indication their relationship with the product breaches ethical standards. Do not do that. But you can get buzz marketing going by having people honestly use your product that you give them for free and share their joy with your product. CRM, customer relationship management, another trend in personal selling. That's the need for all customer contact points, salespeople, customer service, websites, to gather information so that this can be shared with others in the company. So when you have a customer question, when you have a customer complaint, when you want to know where your product is, boom, 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 they just tap their computer. They know all the contact you've had, all the issues, all the positive things, what you bought, etc. But salespeople don't love this either. To get in the information into the customer relationship management system, they've got to share their information. Well, salespeople are good at developing relationships and learning about consumers and getting this information. They don't like sharing the information with the system because they feel that's what makes them important. So for some salespeople, letting go of the information, putting it into the CRM, they feel reduces their importance to the company. As a manager, you got to make sure they understand it's important to cooperate CRM is certainly not going away. It's important to success. No surprise to you that mobile technology and web-based computing would have a positive influence on personal selling. So the Wi-Fi, cellular internet access allows salespeople to retrieve needed information at any time. In a sale, over lunch, the salesperson can quickly access material to respond to questions such as how long it may take to receive a product if an order is placed. I was in sales for a while before any of this stuff existed. And when there was a question, I had to stop the sales process and say, excuse me, do you mind if I borrow your office phone? I'd have to phone my office on a landline phone because there was no other way to do it then, and hope the people on my office answered the phone and knew the question, as opposed to beep, 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 beep. Oh, I got your answer. So it's made, this has made life much easier for salespeople. Web-based customer relationship systems. Salespeople can enter and retrieve the CRM information using a browser, as long as the information has been put in properly by everybody participating. And of course, and especially over the pandemic, but even so, we can do electronic sales presentations. Online video conferencing, massively big during the pandemic. Web and phone conferencing. Online text chatting to answer questions, perhaps, maybe not so much to make a sale. All that's out there helping the professional salesperson. So, what do these people do? Well, they engage in a personal selling process, sales activities that occur before and after the sale itself. Six stages: prospecting, pre-approach, approach, presentation, close, and follow-up. So this is Patrick one more time talking about the sales associate job and the selling process over in his domain.
Going from account management to sales associate is quite a bit different. The biggest differentiator between a sales associate or an account executive, inside, outside sales, you know, there's a bunch of different titles, but you oftentimes are responsible for managing the full sales cycle. So that means that from the top of the process, I'm looking at different industries that are relevant. Fortunately for market research, you know, most companies that are selling goods or services to a consumer are relevant for me, so that makes it a wide net to cast. And then from there, I identified the respective companies. So there's a lot of checking our CRM tool to make sure somebody else isn't already going after them. And then finally, before I even start reaching out to people, it's identifying the right titles and people within those companies. From there, you start to craft what your outreach strategy is going to be. In today's world, a lot of times it's cold calling and cold emailing. And cold calling is definitely the strongest avenues, I think, in my opinion, to take when you're trying to establish a relationship. Oftentimes, in any cold outreach scenario, it takes about 7 to 8 attempts before you can really get in contact with somebody. So definitely keeping high energy, you know, trying to stay optimistic is huge, and something that I still remind myself of, you know, 10 years in. That's kind of my day in a nutshell. And then also, you know, like thinking about rejection. If you're going to get rejected, you want to get to the no as quickly as possible. Of course, you'd like to win everybody's business, but that's just not realistic. So ask hard, open-ended questions. Get people talking. What you're really trying to do is identify and kind of unearth what their pain points are, and then start to figure out how you can help them. Just selling on features, it's not really going to resonate with a lot of people. If you're doing presentations, their eyes are going to start glassing over, and they're going to be thinking about, you know, what they want for dinner. So it's all about them. It's all about how you can help them, how you can help them save money, how you can help them improve their process, collect better insights, whatever their pain point is.
So you bring them value, you help them solve a problem. Of course, they're interested in hearing more about what you have to say. You have to listen to
going
them.
From.
So prospecting is the first step out there. It involves identifying and developing a list of potential clients. So you're doing new business here, obviously. Where do you get these ideas? Well, you were engaged in trade shows. You showed off your product. People dropped their business card in or gave you their contact information. You can buy commercially available databases or mailing lists. You can look back into your CRM, into your sales records and your in-house databases, see who hasn't been active recently. You can check through your social media sites who's registered on your website. What were they asking for? You can check public records, referrals, directories, lots of different places where you can get ideas for people that you might talk to about your product. So prospecting is the starting point for this personal selling process. They should be structured so they identify only potential clients who fit the profile, who are able, willing, and authorized to build a product or services. It's been a long time since we talked in those first few weeks about what is the implications of a market, MAD, money, authority, and demand. We're coming full cycle now, 15 weeks later, to that same concept. When you're doing prospecting, you want to identify people that have money, authority, and demand for your product. I used the example back then where somebody started sending me brochures for yachts. It's a waste of your time, not in the market. Pre-approach. Now you're going to gather information to help you decide how to approach that prospect that you think might benefit from your product. We need to understand the prospect's current needs. What are their pain points? What value can we bring to them? We need to understand their current use of brands and how they like or dislike all the brands that are out there. Back in the old days, I was selling B2B computers, and eventually I left the particular company I was working with because their attitude was promise the customer anything, get the sale, and get out. Whether or not the device did what it was supposed to do, we did not agree on that. I stuck around making sure the device did what it was supposed to do, but a lot of people didn't. So I'd be knocking on doors, hi there, would you like to buy any computers today? And occasionally I'd have somebody say, yeah, come on in, I'm talking to you, my company's suing your company because it didn't do what it was supposed to do. These were not good prospects, and perhaps if we had a better system in place, I would know, don't go knocking on that door, they're suing us, for example. So how do they feel about all current brands and yours too? Figure out who the key decision makers are as best you can at this point in time. Review the account histories, that's sort of to my point. Have they ever dealt with your company before? And assess their product needs. So you begin to have some idea about what you can do for them. Should provide good information to create and plan a sales presentation to address the identified and likely concerns of the products to set our sales call objectives. The pre-approach process results in a preliminary overall strategy for this particular sales call. Of course, it has to be refined as you learn more about the prospect, but you got to get there somehow. The approach. The approach is the actual contact that you have with that prospect. It gets their attention. It stimulates their interest. And if you do a good job, then they want to hear your presentation. As your mama told you, or at least you've heard the thing, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. This is that opportunity to make a good first impression on that potential customer. So, it's the point of the selling process where you meet and greet the prospect, give an introduction, establish a rapport that's going to set the foundation of the relationship. It's where you ask open-ended questions to learn more about the prospect and make sure what you thought was true is still true. Oh, you've decided not to go internationally. Well, that's important for me to know. Moving over to the presentation. Here's where we're going to begin to convert that prospect into a customer based on the value we're going to bring to them, the pain points we're going to fix. So now we're telling the product story in a way that speaks directly to the identified needs and wants of that prospect. And the reason we hire you as a professional salesperson is because you can customize the presentation in the moment. Otherwise, we can just send you a video. So you have to be attentive, you have to listen, and you can customize that presentation as things change. So now we're going to allow the customer to hold or inspect the product or give them a demonstration, maybe a video on our website or some sort of other presentation. Maybe that's where we pull out our sales brochures, our booklets, to show the things that we've convinced them, or hopefully convinced them can help them with the problem. In general, sales professionals should strive to let the prospect do most of the talking. Back in the days of my sales training, I still remember the imagery they gave us of a little cartoon character, the sales guy with big ears, Mr. Big Ears. The point being, you should try to listen to the customer talk, get them to talk, so you know what sort of pain points they have, what sort of questions they have, what sort of things you can fix. So as we address the needs of the prospect as fully as possible, we're showing that we truly understand, we truly care about the needs of that prospect. How easy is it to get in front of a new customer prospecting? We haven't heard from Valerie in a while. Are you going to talk to us, Valerie? Yes, you are.
Let's say there is a new client that we are not in that market. It might be the Department of Labor. So this is the equivalent of cold calling, which again is difficult because these people are so busy. They're working constantly, and to be able to get a meeting with someone that you don't know and try and say, hi, I'm Valerie Twing. I work for this very small consulting company. Can you please have lunch with me? That's a very difficult thing to do. So what we try and do, again, is call and say hello and introduce ourselves, which is possible. And then, again, we will send articles that relate, or we will send maybe a public relations piece that shows how our company has done something that supports a mission that's similar to the Department of Labor's challenge that is coming up. So again, it's looking at how can we actually fill a need that this person has, because otherwise, why would they want to meet with me? It's just another thing on their list of things to do. So we just try and find it in by finding a need and then fulfilling that need.
So we're going to hear from Valerie yet before we're done, but we're not going to hear it today because I'm done. So we'll wrap this up on Wednesday. Have a pleasant evening. Have a pleasant Tuesday. We'll see you Wednesday.